Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Before kicking off today's episode, I wanted to give a quick shout out to FeedSpot for featuring Spies and Lies in their top 10 spy podcasts. And now, on with the show. Welcome to Spies and Lies, an espionage podcast, delving into and analyzing acts of espionage throughout history, tracing the exploits of daring spies, covert operations, assassinations, hacking, secret organizations, and more. Co-hosted by me, Omri Rose, who spent his childhood living undercover, thanks to his dear old dad and co-host, Jason, a retired former spy master of one of the top intelligence agencies in the world. And without further ado, let's dive into today's episode, Mata Hari. The following is an excerpt of the accounts of a British journalist originally published on October 19th, 1917, during Mata Hari's execution. Gently shaking Mata Hari awake, she arose and was told that her hour had come. "May I write two letters?" she asked, and consent was given. Mata Hari given writing supplies and feverishly writing before handing the letters over to her lawyer. Taking her long black velvet cloak, edged with fur, she draped it over herself before putting on a large black felt hat with a black silk ribbon and bow. Slowly, indifferently, she pulled on a pair of black gloves before speaking calmly. "I am ready." Taken to a waiting automobile, Mata Hari was driven to a remote location. The troops were already drawn up for the execution. 12 stood in a line, forming the firing squad, their rifles at ease, and a sub-officer stood behind them, sword drawn. Mata Hari walked to her designated spot, a French officer approaching her, carrying a white cloth, whispering, "The blindfold," to which Mata Hari replied, "Must I wear that? If Madame prefers not, it makes no difference." Mata Hari, not bound and not blindfolded, stood gazing steadfastly at her executioners, a sharp, crackling command sounded, and the 12 soldiers stood at attention. Another command, and their rifles were at their shoulders, each man gazing down his barrel at the breast of the woman, which was their target. She did not move a muscle. And the rest we'll continue with later in the episode. So, Mata Hari, not at all what I expected.
No, I must say that I was quite surprised about some of the things I read about Mata Hari. There were some things I thought that I knew, and apparently I didn't. And I was quite saddened by the story. I think it's a very tragic, tragic story, tragic ending, and...
Maybe.
No, we'll go into it, but not as expected.
Definitely not as expected.
No.
Now, Mata Hari is a name many might be familiar with, because it's become part of the zeitgeist, you could say, of a lot of especially European thought. And she actually inspired this whole concept of the femme fatale, who we see till this day, the spy who uses her feminine guile to get what she wants, the truth being perhaps something a little different.
Yes, very much different. Let's dive into the story and then see what happens.
All right. Well, Mata Hari was an exotic dancer and courtesan. She was famous and sought after in Europe, especially in Paris. But her life was cut short when French authorities accused her of spying in World War I for the Germans, and she was executed. But what's the truth here? Because as we'll come to see, Mata Hari did admit to spying, but claimed she only ever spied for the French. Interesting.
Yes.
Mata Hari was born on the 7th of August in 1876 in Leeuwarden, the Netherlands, But she was not born Mata Hari. She was born Margarita Gertrudia Zeller, Magritte for short. She was the eldest of four with three younger brothers. And despite many claims of other types of heritage, whether they be Jewish, Indonesian, Malay, or Javanese, she was in fact Dutch through and through. Her father owned a hat shop and invested in oil, becoming very successful. And with this success, he spoiled Magritte. At six, she became the talk of the town when she traveled in a goat-drawn carriage her father had given her. In school, she was known to be flamboyant, appearing in flashy new dresses quite often. She was offered a great education thanks to her father's success until she was about 13, when everything fell apart, because her father became bankrupt. Her parents soon divorced, her father remarried, and not long after, her mother died in 1891. Magritte went to live with her godfather and actually studied to become a kindergarten teacher. However, during her studies, she had an affair with the headmaster, which was a scandal, and she was removed from the institute, fleeing to her uncle in The Hague. At 18, she answered a newspaper ad by the Dutch colonial army captain Rudolf MacLeod. The ad was looking for a wife, and was placed as a joke by his friends, supposedly, Magritte sending a striking photo of herself, raven-haired and olive-skinned, to entice him. She was a very beautiful woman, after all. Not long after, the pair married in Amsterdam on the 11th of July, 1895, while MacLeod was on home leave from the Dutch East Indies, which is now Indonesia. He was nearly 20 years her senior, a bald man with a big mustache, but who knows? Maybe it was a true romance, a beautiful marriage, love at first sight. What do you think, Dad?
I don't think so. I think she was looking for a father figure, looking for someone to take care of her. I think she was betrayed up till now by all the people she loved, and she needed someone that will take care of her. She was used to a certain life, and that's what she was looking for. And it all over, all if you look at all her adventures afterwards, it's a motif that continues the whole time.
Now, MacLeod was from an affluent Dutch family with Scottish ancestry, hence his name. Because he was from such a stable family, Magritte felt her finances were secured, and she was moving into the upper class of society.
Where she felt that's where she should be.
Yes, which was like her childhood.
Yes.
In 1897, they moved to Java in Indonesia. They had two children, a son in 1897, and a daughter in 1898. And though this is where the story might end, with this kind of happy marriage, children, everything, it wasn't quite the case, because their married life was not a success. MacLeod was alcoholic, and regularly beat her, as well as practicing the local custom in the Dutch East Indies of openly having a concubine. For a time, Magritte even moved in with another Dutch officer, living with him. It's at this point that Mata Hari was born, because she began studying Indonesian culture and dance, joining a local company, eventually announcing her new artistic name in correspondences back to the Netherlands. Mata Hari being the sun, literally translated as eye of the day in local Malay languages that she was exposed to. MacLeod eventually did convince Mata Hari to return to him, but the situation didn't improve, unfortunately. At one point, he even almost killed her with a knife, but Mata Hari fell over a chair, giving her time to escape the room. And continuing to escape from her horrible life, she delved deeper into Indonesian culture. In 1899, however, a tragedy occurred. Their children got very ill with complications related to syphilis, which was likely contracted by the parents, Mata Hari and MacLeod, MacLeod having gotten it earlier and probably having given it to Mata Hari. The family, however, claimed that the illness was poisoned by an irate servant, and unfortunately, Mata Hari and MacLeod's son died, but their daughter survived. Some sources even go so far as to claim one of MacLeod's enemies poisoned their food to try to kill them. But as we'll come to see with Mata Hari's story, so much of it remains in mystery and unknown. Moving back to the Netherlands, the pair separated on the 30th of August, 1902. Their divorce finalized in 1906, Mata Hari gaining custody of her daughter. But she was never paid child support. And on her daughter's visit to MacLeod on one occasion, he simply didn't return her to Mata Hari, who had no means to support her. And even though he was an abusive husband, Mata Hari did feel he was a good father. So she resigned herself to the situation, unfortunately. And this is where the story truly begins.
It's interesting to say that's the last record of her actually being involved in Indonesia. All the rest of her history and all the things she did are related now to Europe, and specifically France and Germany, Spain. And we'll get to that later.
But 5 years she was in Indonesia.
Yeah. And those 5 years, actually, in everybody's mind, is Mata Hari, Indonesia, Mata Hari, Batavia, as they called it then, the Dutch colonies there. And she picked up from there something, I'm not talking about the disease, that made her very unique. And that uniqueness was the key for her success and for her failure.
Well, exactly like you said, we're talking about Indonesia and we think about Indonesia, and that's what she would have wanted, because that's how we'll come to see she chose to present herself to the world. In 1903, after losing her daughter, Matahari moved to Paris to start over, saying she wanted to live like a colorful butterfly in the sun, taking many odd jobs to make money, including performing as a circus horse rider and also posing as an artist's model, struggling to earn a living. Then, drawing on her experiences in the Dutch East Indies, she developed a so-called Hindu dance act and began performing, part of her routine being slowly stripping off her colorful robes and veils until nearly nude. Adding to her mystique, she adopted her old stage name, Matahari, later saying, "I never could dance well. People came to see me because I was the first who dared to show myself naked to the public." Claiming she was a Javanese princess of priestly Hindu birth, she pretended to have been immersed in sacred Indian dance since childhood. These kinds of fake backstories for performers were relatively common at the time. What was different here is that almost everyone believed her claims, as the Dutch East Indies were not very well known in Europe at the time. On the 13th of March, 1905, she performed her debut, and she was a sensation from the start, quickly becoming the longtime mistress of a millionaire who had founded the theater she performed in. Reviewers praising her, writing, "Matahari personifies all the poetry of India, its mysticism, its voluptuousness, its languor, its hypnotizing charm." Forget the fact that she never claimed she was from India. Just shows you the knowledge of geography at the time. But this idea of exoticism captivated. Matahari's dances elevated the form of erotic dance to a more respectable status, breaking new ground in a style of entertainment that Paris will later become famous for. The whole Moulin Rouge and everything. Yes. So she was kind of the first to popularize this in a big way. She was declared a star of dance in 1908 and traveled Europe to sold-out crowds and took on lovers and dalliances with powerful men, aristocrats, military men, journalists, and basically anyone who
would pay
or took her fancy.
Yes.
And they all showered her with gifts. At one point, she may have even been a millionaire. Now, she got past the obscenity laws of the day by claiming that her dances were based on Eastern temple rituals. And during her performances, she explained in French, Dutch, English, German, and Malay that,
"My dance is a sacred poem. One must always translate the three stages that correspond to the divine attributes of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, creation, fecundity, destruction. Each movement is a word, and whose every word is underlined by music. The temple in which I dance can be vague or faithfully reproduced, for I am the temple."
A French journalist wrote that Matahari was
so feline, extremely feminine, majestically tragic, the thousand curves and movements of her body trembling in a thousand rhythms.
A Viennese journalist added that she was
slender and tall, with flexible grace of a wild animal, and with blue-black hair, her face making a strange foreign impression.
Clearly, they bought her exoticism.
Yes, look at the time of where she was acting and what she was doing and where she came from. And that was the only way she could really make some money. And she knew the way to do it and take advantage of the knowledge picked up in Indonesia and bring it to the French audience. And Paris was the place she went to.
And I mean, she toured all over. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it was interesting that she never went back straight to the Netherlands. Never thought of going back to Holland.
To perform?
To perform, or even...
Well, they knew about Indonesia more in Holland, right?
Yes.
And they knew her more in certain parts.
So she preferred to go to where they didn't know her. And where, obviously, there was more of an audience in Paris, and that's where she went.
Yeah. Now, she was photographed repeatedly and provocatively during this time, her ex-husband McCloyd obtaining some of these photos and strengthening his claim in keeping custody of their daughter. And Matahari, writing on the 28th of March in 1904, said how she missed her daughter and was even contemplating suicide.
"My child, my house, my comfort, don't think that I'm bad at heart. I have done it only out of poverty."
By 1910, at 38 years old, Matahari's star began fading, and younger imitators were taking the spotlight, as critics began snubbing her act as cheap exhibitionism. Her final show was in 1915. But Matahari became a successful courtesan afterwards, and her relationships with powerful men allowed her free travel across Europe, as well as the advantage of her Dutch neutrality in the war that broke out in 1914, the war being World War I. But Mata Hari's free movements across borders attracted attention, and she became increasingly suspicious to British and French intelligence, not least of which, when World War I broke out, she was in Germany, England and France's enemy. Yet little did they know that when she actually left Germany, her bank accounts were frozen there and her luggage seized. So, a little bit of mixed up intelligence, which, as we'll come to see, is a bit of a theme here.
Yes, very unfortunate for her.
How do you account for all this bad intelligence that we're going to come to see?
Actually, I thought there was some very good intelligence that came out as well, but we'll get to that later.
Okay. And so we come to the great mystery of Mata Hari, her espionage career. Mata Hari is synonymous with espionage. And yet, as the case may be, she may not have been much of a spy at all. And if she was likely not a very good one. Would you agree?
I would agree. I didn't see anything about any training she went through. She didn't have to do anything specific or special, and we'll get to it in a moment.
Well, you could argue that the training she had was just her life experiences of, you know, interacting with so many different cultures and people and the languages that she learned, because she was obviously educated in many different languages and that kind of stuff. I mean, you could see why someone would want to recruit her at this point, potentially. Here's a person with a neutral passport who can travel all across Europe, who has dalliances with people from all over society and cultures, could potentially be a great source of information, right? I mean, it makes sense to approach someone like this.
It makes sense to approach someone like that, yes. But let's see what happened.
You'll reserve your judgment till the end, is that what you're saying?
Just before the end, because we heard about the end.
Okay. In 1915, Mata Hari returned to the Netherlands and started seeing the Honorary Council of Germany in the Netherlands, Karl Kromer. Little did she know, Karl Kromer worked for the German Secret Service. He offered Mata Hari 20,000 francs to spy for the Kaiser, and needing the cash, she took it. But later, she claimed to have never agreed to take the job, only the cash, saying she believed the payment was reimbursement for what was seized from her a year earlier. Remember her luggage and bank accounts. Also, bear in mind, she was seeing this guy, so the payment could have been interpreted in lots of different ways. What's the truth? Was she spying or was she not? It's unclear if she ever did conduct any espionage for Germany, at least at that point. But what we do know is she does return to Paris not long after, perhaps simply due to having the cash to do so now. However, taking a boat to France from the Netherlands, it stops in the UK, where she's questioned by an intelligence officer. Her knowledge of languages, English, French, Italian, Dutch, probably German and some Malay, and upper class and well put together appearance, making her very suspicious. The officer saying, she should be refused permission to be allowed to return to the United Kingdom. The officer sending a message to the French intelligence before releasing Mata Hari.
I find this very interesting, this piece of information, because there's two things to look at, or three things to look at this article you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. One, that the British intelligence had someone to question people who were transiting, because she wasn't actually going into the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to identify, out of all the people who were on the boat, or the ship, or whatever was or vessel she was on, that she was a person that they should look into, because they had no information about her. Do you think it was 1915. I mean, it wasn't computers, there was no emails, there was nothing. It was just one man asking questions, have no information of someone coming before. No one alerted him to it, as far as we understand. So that's one interesting thing that he was able to identify. So it shows you the professionality of the people.
Sure. Yeah.
And the second thing is that he felt that it's important to alert the French. That means that at that time...
Well, she was going to Paris.
Yes, but he heard from her enough to understand that maybe there's a case here. And even if you think about those years that the British decided, wait a minute, we should alert the French about it. That means even in those years, there was a relationship or a connection or cooperation between the British and the French.
From their intelligence agencies.
From the intelligence agencies.
Because they were at war together.
Yes, they were
Germany.
Together. But still, you look at it more of as an individual thing, as we've seen in other cases, that not everybody tells everybody about mm-hmm. other things that are going on. And in this case, although there was nothing specific, he felt it was important enough that what he heard from her when he questioned her at the boat, and we don't know exactly what came up there, that he said the French should know about her. Why? Probably there was something in her story that he felt that they should look at. Now, if he would have thought that she's worthwhile recruiting, why didn't he recruit? Why wouldn't he do that? I mean, if he knew that she was recruited by someone else, it's one thing. But if she wasn't recruited, why didn't he try and recruit her? So I feel that he knew a little bit more about it and they didn't want to be involved because she wasn't going to the UK. And thought, you know what, let the French deal with her and see what happens. It set up something that actually changed her whole fate.
Well, let's break this down a little bit. She never performed in the UK as far as I'm aware.
Correct.
So she wasn't as well known in the UK. So let's begin with that. Passports were a thing that existed back then. So
yes.
Presumably when she was in transit, there would have been a line. You're in transit, you go to this line. You're coming to England, you go to that line. On the line of the in transit, they're looking at the passport. Now, in comes Mata Hari, who is an extravagant, beautiful, a person who stands out, let's say.
Yes.
So they're going to take
traveling
a little bit...
Traveling alone, probably.
Yes, with baggage and wealth. So they're going to take a little bit longer to look at her passport, maybe. They open the passport and they see, you've been to Germany, you've been to France, you've been to Spain, you've been all over, and recently to Germany, in fact, after the war began. How did you get out? There's a war. How is this possible? The passport, I imagine, is what raised certain questions. And then questioned her, why are you going to Paris? Da, 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 da. So to me, it follows logic that they would question her. Whether it was a brilliant intelligence officer to have identified her or not, I don't think it was necessarily. I think it would have been quite clear that she's a person that you need to suspect.
Now, you remember the borders. I mean, leaving, going from the Netherlands, I don't know where from, what port it was. Probably, let's say Rotterdam. Why
Rotterdam.
Didn't they go directly to France? So they went through UK. So it was it they had to change a ship? Probably.
Well, you wouldn't go by land because of the war.
Because of the war. But still, it was an interesting scenario, in my opinion, there. Okay, let's continue.
Let's continue, yes. In Paris, Mata Hari carries on with her usual dalliances and also falls in love with a young Russian pilot serving with the French, who is actually significantly younger than her. This pilot actually even eventually proposes to her, and she accepts. But in 1916, the Russian pilot becomes grievously injured, and Mata Hari is unable to visit him in the field hospital because she doesn't have permission. So, using her contacts that she's made amongst the different people that she associates with, she tries to find a way to get to him. And eventually, word reaches French intelligence, which was led by a man named Captain Ledoux, which I'm probably butchering his name, so I apologize for the French out there. He found out about Mata Hari's attempts to reach her Russian lover and intercepted Mata Hari, seeing an opportunity. He explained to her that unless she agreed to spy on Germany, they won't permit her to see her husband-to-be. Now, there are two versions of what comes next. Either Mata Hari is set up to fail to prove that she's a German spy because Captain Ledoux suspected as such or knew as such due to English intelligence or suspicions that he had, and as a result of which he would tell her to travel to The Hague via Spain and await instructions, which never came, which we'll get into, or he was genuinely interested in her spying for France and wanted her to try to reach the German crown prince. The reason for which is because before the war, she actually performed for the German crown prince, who was now a senior general on the Western Front. However, his involvement in the actual military was very minimal and much to do with German propaganda at the time. And it was bad French intelligence to never consider this fact that he never even really commanded anything larger than a regiment. So this whole trumped up idea that he was the leader and in charge and they have to infiltrate him was all German propaganda to make the Kaiser's family seem great. Regardless, in this version, Captain Ledoux wanted Mata Hari to seduce him for secrets. In both versions, she's offered £1 million as a reward for her services.
Very strange. When I read about it and said, £1 million?
That's absurd.
Yeah. I mean, even today...
That's like $5 million today or something.
Yeah. First of all, he didn't have that money to give. Second, who gives that kind of money out? And third, it doesn't make sense. But it does make sense that he wanted to recruit her. Now, what did he know when he wanted to recruit her? We don't know. Did she even manage to get to see her fiancé? We don't even know that either. And what kind of training or contacts did he give her to do the job?
None.
So what's it all about?
So what comes next, in both cases, is rather interesting. Because whatever the truth may be, contact with Ledoux is shoddy at best. She's given no training, as we said, no real support, not even a target, if we go by the first version that he recruited her to prove that she was guilty. But if he recruited her with the target of the Kaiser, then she was given a target. Eventually, Matahari wrote to him through normal post, she wasn't given a special way to contact him or anything, that she needed an advance payment to buy new clothes if she was going to seduce someone. A key here might be that she says someone and not specifically the Kaiser, but we don't know what her train of thought was. So, no contact, no support, no training, no advance payment, nothing. And either wait for instructions, go to Holland through Spain to try to catch her as a spy, or go seduce this guy and try to find a way, but no direction of how to do that exactly. Very suspicious. Eventually, Matahari travels to Holland via Spain, as one version of the story says she was instructed to do, and traveling by boat, she's stopped again in the United Kingdom. This time, she's seized and arrested by Scotland Yard, possibly to do with the fact that she was advised never to come back again by intelligence, and this time, she's interrogated and admits to working for French intelligence. But the French don't confirm this. Ladal writes to Scotland Yard saying, "Understand nothing. Send Matahari back to Spain." The British files, summarizing his reply as, "Ladal suspected her for some time and pretended to employ her in order to, if possible, obtain definitive proof that she is working for the Germans." Based on this, one would suspect that the British either knew something or suspected something. Again, not entirely clear what's going on here.
No, not at all. It's very unclear, the situation here. I mean, okay, she arrives in the UK when she knows that there might be something going wrong. Now, who does she say she works for? For the French. Not for the Germans, but the French. Of course, she's not going to say she works for the Germans.
No, because they're at war and the French are their allies.
Yeah. Okay, so she works for the French. And she feels comfortable to say it because they're the allies.
But then she's interrogated first. She doesn't immediately say it.
Well, of course not. Just, "I work for the French." No, she doesn't go out and say that. But when she's asked or interrogated in a certain time, she wasn't 100% trained to handle it.
Well, she wasn't trained at all.
Right. So her best thing is to say, "Yes, I'm working for the French. You check with the French." That would be the right thing for her to do. Now, what happens is that the French deny. Now, it's very strange, the French reaction.
Very strange.
Now, there's no records of it. We don't know.
Well, there's a record of the reply.
But there's no records in the French establishment about her involvement as being a spy. Or is there? We don't know.
French records have been sealed for a long time. They only recently were released. And even then, there's so much controversy and things redacted and not there. And the Germans actually released, I think it was in the 50s, information that they say she didn't actually spy for them. But again, we don't know.
We don't know.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Let's look at the two situations for a moment. Scenario number one, Ladau had hired her to actually spy for the French and infiltrate the German crown prince. Why would he deny? Why would he send her back to Spain? Thoughts?
It's legitimate for... It does need her in France.
But why back to Spain rather than... If he wants her to infiltrate him at the Western Front, surely he wants her closer.
He doesn't need her in France because...
Yes.
That's where they are. He needs her somewhere neutral where she can get information because he has other assets that he can use in France.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows... And she can travel and she can go even to Germany if necessary. So let's use her. That's great. That's the right thing to do, you would say.
But why deny? If he's actually... We're taking a scenario where he's actually employing her and believes that she's a French spy.
If she works for him, he doesn't want the British to know because it could jeopardize her mission, because if the British are infiltrated or someone might say something or a document will go out, then he's jeopardizing as an asset. He doesn't want to do that. Could be as well he's not interested that the British would know that to confess who is and who is not working for him.
Interestingly,
but the third thing I would say is actually he never reported to his commanders or to his superiors, who he was the main man, maybe, that he is actually running an agent. It's not his job to run agents. If he's the head of the service, he runs an agent? No, that's not your job. So why isn't there someone else that he can make sure was in her contact? Was it something else he was doing? Was he playing a game? Was he doing something different? Was it he's doing, I won't say he had personal interest, but later on we find out maybe more about this gentleman. Maybe he did not, as an official letter came in saying, is she an agent? He never declared her as an agent, and he maybe wanted no one to know that he is actually asked her to be an agent. Therefore, it's easier to say, send her back. She has nothing to do with anything.
Interestingly,
I think that's the more likely scenario.
Also, he could have just as easily said, keep her imprisoned. But no, if she was actually working for him and he didn't want to admit it, he said, send her back to Spain. At least maybe then she can continue her mission. So there is that aspect.
Yes.
Let's look at the other scenario. He wanted her to get to Holland through Spain to uncover her as a German spy. If that was his initial instruction, why doesn't he say release her to Holland instead of back to Spain? Doesn't make sense, right? Very confusing.
Let's continue because I think the next story explains much more.
Okay. Back in Spain in 1916, Mata Hari meets the German major Kalle, who either of her own initiative to try to do something for France, or under instruction from French authorities, or because she was actually a German spy and he was a contact of hers, she reaches out to him and they begin a flirtation. He actually becomes enamored with her. And after three afternoons in bed, he tells her that German troops and allies are planning a landing in Morocco, which was then a French colony. This is huge news. And apparently, Mata Hari then sends a message to Ladau, but gets no response. Mata Hari, seeking advice, turns to a French lover in Spain, who asks her to get more information from the German major, which she manages to do so. But the Germans then become suspicious. Other versions of events is that she requested from the major to arrange a meeting with the German crown prince. Remember, that was one version of the thing. Offering French intelligence in exchange for German intelligence, or even cash. Or that she even, at that point, offered to spy for the Germans. So there's a lot of different situations going on here. Let's look at situation number one. When she accepted the 20,000 francs in Holland, she became a German spy. This was a contact. This was a handler. Go back into there. And now she's also a double agent infiltrating the French. And so she's passing on the information there and trying to play both sides. That's possibly Ladau's version of events, that she's a German spy and this was her contact, blah, 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 blah. Then there's the version of events that she was sent to try to infiltrate the crown prince. And in Spain, she's trying to do this and trying to play that maybe she can offer French intelligence in exchange to try to get closer so that she can get closer to the Crown Prince. Or there's the version where she's just bumbling along, trying to do something for France and winds up with him and gets this information and genuinely is trying to serve France and tries to reach Ladau, but it goes nowhere.
Well, I want to look at something else here. I want to look at the information that she received.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, in my opinion, what's the keynote.
Mm-hmm.
She got information that's obviously very, very important about a possible attack by the Germans on Morocco. Now, if no one knew about it, and this is going to happen, that's a piece of information you really want to know. Now, there's two things here. Is it real information or is it information that was given to her by the Germans so that they can know that she works with the French and then they can see that actually she's been doubled? And therefore, they cannot trust her anymore.
Yes, because one version of events is the Germans become suspicious once she starts asking all these questions.
So the question is this information a genuine information that this kind of information should have not fallen into the Allied hands? Now, if that's the case, then the Germans did not know at that stage, or her handler wouldn't have said what he said. But if it is false information, and it's good enough information to know that it will go to whoever it goes to, then it will immediately come to the attention of the Germans that she is not working for them anymore, and therefore she is not someone they can trust. So for the Germans, it's a very clear-cut situation, in my opinion, about what's going on here, if they have a suspicion on her. From the French point of view, if it's such good information and it's not answering, why aren't they doing something about it?
Well, she was never given a contact either. She's sending mail through the regular post and telegrams and no contact.
But a friend who knew something, okay, so she went to him, she told him, he said, oh, that sounds interesting, getting more information. So there's someone else there who should be on her side, who's a French patriot, you could say, who understands the importance of what is going on. Again, this is a very, very important key element of what happened there, because that was the key of everything, really. Mm. I mean, where is she, a German spy, a French spy, or just someone who is trying to
bumble along,
just to make ends meet and see what's happening? And I think the latter is the right thing. I don't think she knew exactly what was going on anyway.
I don't think she knew if she was a spy or not.
I don't think she... let's come to it later.
Whatever the truth was, when Mata Hari returned to Paris after getting no response from Ladeau, French intelligence had intercepted a coded message that the German major had sent to Berlin about a German spy codenamed H-21, which they interpreted as fitting Mata Hari's description to a T. Now, the German major's message may have been a calculated ploy to expose Mata Hari, because he sent the message in an old code that the Germans knew the Allies had already cracked, perhaps because they were suspicious that she was working for the French and were trying to frame her. Or maybe they got sloppy. Who knows? What we do know is that it was all the evidence Ladeau needed that she was working for Germany. And on February 13th, 1917, Mata Hari was arrested and confined to Paris's infamous flea and rat-infested cells in the Saint-Lazare prison. Months passed before her trial began on the 24th of July, 1917, Mata Hari charged with conducting espionage for Germany. At this time, France was in need of a scapegoat and a moral boost after suffering many, many losses. And this might be exactly what they needed. Mata Hari was adamant that she was never a spy for any country other than France, saying, "A courtesan, I admit it. A spy, never. I have encountered in this world riffraff and good people. I lose, I win, I defend myself when I am attacked. I take when someone is taken from me. But I beg you to believe me, I have never done an act of espionage against France. Never, never." When questioned about the German major's message, she said that she had accepted money in the past, but denied ever passing secrets to Germans, saying, "I never considered myself a German agent with a number because I never did anything for them." So she admitted to the money that she got in Holland, the 20,000 francs, but never admitted to anything else. Her prosecutor, at what was essentially a show trial with a verdict already set, said, "The evils that this woman has done..." He's not German. He should be French.
I'm surprised at you.
"The evil that this woman has done is unbelievable. This is perhaps the greatest woman spy of the century."
What do you think of that statement?
He was right and wrong in the same sentence.
Mata Hari was blamed during the trial for an intel leak that caused 50,000 casualties at a recent battle. However, there was no real evidence against Mata Hari.
No.
Ladeau's telegrams and radio messages that he intercepted are actually now considered to have been doctored by him, and evidence such as a regular stipend payment from a Dutch baron admirer of Mata Hari was twisted in court to be coming from German spy masters. The Dutch baron never was called to testify, nor was Mata Hari's maid, who acted as an intermediary for the baron's payments. In less than an hour, Mata Hari was found guilty by a military tribunal and sentenced to death, Mata Hari exclaiming, "It's impossible, it's impossible," upon hearing the verdict. And now to continue the account by the British journalist, published on October 19th, 1917. "The officer in charge of the execution extended his sword into the air as the sun, by this time up, flashed on the blade before it descended in a falling arc. Simultaneously, the sound of the volley rang out, flame and tiny puffs of grayish smoke issuing from each rifle as Mata Hari fell. But she did not die as actors and moving picture stars would have you believe when shot. She did not throw up her hands, nor did she plunge straight forward or straight back. Instead, she seemed to slowly collapse, settling to her knees, her head always up, and without the slightest change of expression. For the fraction of a second, it seems as if she tottered there on her knees, gazing directly at those who had taken her life. Then she fell backward and lay prone, motionless, with her face turned towards the sky. A non-commissioned officer drew his revolver from his holster, approached, and bent over her, moving the muzzle of his revolver towards Matahari's left temple. He pulled the trigger, the bullet tearing into the brain of the woman. Matahari was surely dead.
Well, as we said, very tragic. If I have to sum up the whole situation here, the whole story, I would put it in one word: betrayal. She was betrayed by everyone who said he'll take care of her, starting from her father, who left the family, or you could say from the bankruptcy, then left the family, left her with her mother, then her mother left her. Okay, she died young, but again, someone was supposed to take care of her. Then a schoolmaster, then a husband. And in the professional world of the espionage, the people who she was supposed to trust betrayed her. You would say that anyone she went to, in the end, turned against her. It's very tragic, a very sad story. If you look at it from the point of view of a professional and personal situation that went through in her life.
Mm.
Professionally, it was a disaster. I mean, of course, you can't judge things that today as it was or then. But it's a sad story. The only happy thing about it is that her life has been immortalized, that her name lives on.
Absolutely.
as not someone who's been forgotten, as someone who had something, who did something, who maybe was an inspiration for other women in other, different aspects, not exactly the ones that you would think about.
Well, during her life, she fascinated the world, or at least Europe. And her life continues to fascinate to this day. Documents from her trial that were sealed for decades only recently were opened, and many who've studied them have actually concluded that the case against her was very weak. Most of the prosecution's evidence was circumstantial. Her defense attorney was prevented from introducing witnesses backing her claims. And there's mixed views if Matahari was ever actually really a spy. Some say she was scapegoated or framed in order to raise morale, you know, blaming
yes.
the French losses. And those that believe she was a spy say she must have been a very low-level one at best. The true extent of her espionage really may never be known for certain.
There's not even one report anywhere in any archive of anything that she mentioned or said.
Certainly,
right?
She didn't give any evidence that was
no.
particularly valuable to any side.
She
of
might
any...
have had something when she talked about the Germans wanting to attack Morocco, but is there any one piece of note of information that was passed on to the Germans or to the French or to anyone else coming from her that was worthwhile something? Nothing that we're aware of.
Interestingly, Matahari's body was given for medical study because no one was willing to claim her body. No family member was. And her head was actually embalmed at the Museum of Anatomy in Paris. But in the year 2000, it was discovered that it had disappeared, possibly as early as 1954, and it's still missing. Records from 1918 show that the museum also received the rest of her body, but none of it is accounted for. Finally, another little interesting bit of note is that later, Ladeau, the French intelligence officer, was charged with being a double agent himself, but was eventually cleared of the charges. So, interesting little bit of information to consider, yes. adding to the whole confusion of this story. And that's her life. It remains captivating to this day, and not at all what I expected when you think of the legendary spy Matahari. When you actually dive into it, it's not at all that.
No. Lies.
Lies. Spies and lies.
Yes. Yes.
There's been so many movies and books and productions around her. There's a ballet now in Holland about her. There's a big museum. She was immortalized by Greta Garbo in early Hollywood. She's captivated. Yeah, very sad, as you've said. It's a sad story, really, at the end of the day, because not one of the, well, if it's this version of events, is particularly very, very nice to think about. I mean, I suppose for us in the West, the most positive version is she was a spy for Germany and we got her. But even if she was a spy for Germany and quote unquote, we got her, the punishment for her crime, which was very low level spying at best, was completely out of proportion.
Look, she was executed by the people she worked for. What kind of message is that?
She thought she worked for
them. She worked for them.
She thought she worked for them.
Yes. And she was executed by the people she trusted the most, who she felt that she was working for. That's not a very nice thing, is it?
No, not very nice at all. Would you hire her?
I was thinking about it earlier. And I would say that her capability to move in the circles she did were very, very tempting. But to run a person like that, you have to have very, very close contact. You have to have a handler on the job all the time because of her character. Not so aware that she'll betray you, but she needs
her
guidance.
Her lack of training. You need someone to
Tell her where to. Exactly. You just can't say, go somewhere and do something. But again, it's different times. But still, the question is a legitimate question. A person like that moves in the circles that she was moving in, you cannot say, no, I'm not interested. It's just not right. You do have to find a way to run a person like that in the most cautious and discreet way.
It makes sense why she would be an option, at least. You know, we will eventually do an episode on another famous person who maneuvered in kind of these circles during World War I, which was Houdini. He was also actually recruited to be a spy as part of his career as he performed in different places. His story may be a little bit more successful than Mata Hari's, but it's interesting. You know, these kind of famous people, it's a known thing to use them because they have access.
When you look at the motive for her working for the different people she worked with, she was supposed to be a millionaire. So what, they took all her money and she was left with nothing? So she was it was all a matter of being in the wrong place in the wrong time, being in Germany would you take all your money with you? I mean, that doesn't make sense. You don't have no other money to go. For 20,000 francs, you get in advance. I mean, that doesn't happen. You don't get the kind of money like that. A million francs that were promised by the French. That's ridiculous. Yeah, and then she has to beg for some money to get something. I mean, who paid for her traveling? Okay, did she get any money?
I find
so many things here that don't make sense as a professional way. Just doesn't
click.
Doesn't feel right as running someone like that as an agent.
I mean, let's take Virginia Hall, who we talked about in the second episode, who was very independent and you kind of threw into a situation and she found her way. With a person like that, you can understand, go infiltrate and then she'll just do it. But she had training as well. So let's not forget that. And she was a different type of person.
Exactly.
So it's also knowing who you're dealing with, right?
Because Mata Hari didn't have to be someone else. She had to be Mata Hari.
Yeah.
She wasn't supposed to be undercover. She wasn't supposed to go and do something different.
Correct.
She wasn't Mata Hari at night, and in the daytime she went out.
She was supposed to be Mata Hari, and as Mata Hari, seduced this guy because she was Mata Hari.
Good at seducing people because she knew how to do it, and because of her name and her reputation, people fell for it because they wanted to. It was like, wow, I met Mata Hari. I was with Mata Hari. It wasn't like, okay, it was a bad thing. Wow. It was like, I have now a badge. I've been to Mata Hari. I've been with Mata Hari. Mm-hmm. So yes, that she didn't have to do much. All you had is someone to direct her to do things. But was it done professionally? No. That's why, again, I'm looking at the British and I'm saying to myself, why the British new to spot talent and know how to spot something that's right. We noticed that before. Why did they give up on her? Why didn't they say to themselves, let's go and have a go at her?
Why wasn't she an interesting thing for them? Maybe exactly. They didn't know her, right? Because she didn't perform there. So they didn't know really what she could do for them.
I know, but still a question. Did they know something else or were they worried? Was there something in her story that
she didn't go to
something?
Eaton or Cambridge, so they didn't want to.
No, but remember with
Virginia Hall,
they decided to recruit her when they noticed that she was someone that could be interesting because they spotted her. So they do know how to spot the people. So why didn't they do something? That's interesting.
Virginia Hall being 30 years after the events of Mata Hari's life.
I know. It's different.
The British are a bit old-fashioned.
No, but look at it. Again, it's a foreigner, someone who can travel and move the lines, who knows the language, who has a reputation.
More of an asset than a spy.
It was a younger version of her. But the British at that time, maybe they were not really looking to do more or outside of the UK at the time? I don't know. We don't know.
Well, I want to ask you, because I mentioned this when you were talking, maybe they saw her potentially as an asset rather than a spy. But then I thought more about that question. What's the difference, actually? You know, someone who's an informant versus someone who's actively a spy for you.
I don't want to go into the semantics of what's an asset, what's a spy at this stage. I just want to say that she was placed in a situation that she could bring information to the French on the Germans. If they wanted to run her properly, she could have brought in a lot of good information, as she showed that she could. Why wasn't she allowed to do it? That is the big question here. Why did they decide to put her on trial?
So you think she had potential to be a great spy?
She had potential to, I wouldn't say great spy, she had potential to get places that the French would have had difficulties getting to with normal assets. And she was willing to work for them, and they had something in their hand. She had a fiancé who was not even French, and she wasn't even French, but willing to work for them, who the Germans at that stage trusted. You just don't throw it away unless, you know, unless she's burnt, unless the Germans found out that she works for the French. Now, that is a question we don't know why.
We talked previously of the honeypot method, seduction in as a tool in spycraft. But is there ever the honeypot as the spy method?
It's more or less the same thing. Two ways to look at it. One is to get information through her from the contacts she has. The other thing is that through the contacts she makes, to make contact with them and try and recruit them, because now you know something about them. But that wasn't the case with her. They wanted her to get information from people that she met. They didn't say to her, listen, we want you to make contact with people and then we'll try and recruit them. Or get something bad about them, or something that there's, we can blackmail, or something else, and we can use it against them. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the case here. So it's the same thing, in my opinion. She wasn't going to be something else. She was Mata Hari. And as I said, she didn't have to work to be Mata Hari.
She just was.
She just was this woman that people wanted to be associated with because it gave them something they can talk about, and that was good enough. They didn't need more than that.
So was she a victim and pawn in the game of spies?
She was very much a victim.
What lessons can we learn from Mata Hari, someone delving into the world of espionage?
Well, there's many lessons. First of all, if someone offers you $1 million, it's not real.
Francs, yeah.
That's why. If someone offers you $1 million on
ask
the table.
In advance.
In advance.
No, ask for an advance.
Ask for an advance. So you can have something. But look, again, it's
what would
look at it as well from her point of view. Is $1 million something that she was, if she is used to getting gifts and presents in from high-level people and high-ranking people, and this guy is the head of the intelligence, so-called, even though he's a captain. But still, she's used to getting gifts and money and jewelry and all sorts of good stuff from people for her favors. So she expects that, but not that kind of money.
It's a lot.
It doesn't make sense. Now, why would when what stage does she get it?
Well, it only makes sense if it's part of this whole thing. If you manage to infiltrate the Crown Prince of the Western Front, then yeah, you've earned $1 million.
Then she could have still done it. But why didn't he was allowed to do it? Unless
it was a setup.
It was a setup. Unless they thought from the beginning she cannot be trusted. She is a German spy, and therefore we have to find a way to eliminate her or get her away from any asset that could be damaging for us. And that's why she was put on trial. In the end, the French believed, or at least that's how the story goes, that she was a German spy. We don't care about what she did for us because it wasn't important enough. And that's why we executed her, because we needed her as a boost morale for our country, and she served her country well by doing that. So, was she a hero for the French in the end?
It's a twisted way to look at it.
I know.
Anything else you want to say?
No. Well, it's just sad. It's when you look at it, it's a sad story of a person trying to make a living and trying to make a mark in the world, and
with a tragic life.
And yes, a tragic life. She died when she was in her 40s.
Early 40s, yeah. Well, we'll end with a quote from Mata Hari herself. I am a woman who enjoys herself very much. Sometimes I lose, sometimes I win.
Death is nothing, nor life either, for that matter. To die, to sleep, to pass into nothingness, what does it matter? Everything is an illusion.
And she created the greatest illusion of it all, the illusion of Mata Hari. This was Spies and Lies. Thanks for listening. And remember, if someone offers you £1 million...
I would recommend to ask for an advance.
Spies and Lies is a Grumpy Golem production, with original scoring and mastering by Julian Dussault. If you enjoyed listening, don't forget to share with your friends and leave a comment or review wherever you're listening from. If you have any questions or subjects you'd like for my father and I to cover, drop us a message, and we'll do our best to get back to you. Until next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.